Good afternoon, let's start. Welcome to week 9, the third of 4 lectures on syntax. Next week is going to be the last week. I'm sure this is going to be an extremely popular lecture. I'm not sure how many are going to be here. There was one year when I did the Friday lecture, which was actually the day before Christmas. There were 27 people, and I brought some cookies, and so, yeah, it's dangerous. Now maybe more people are going to come, but we'll see. First of all, I have to apologize for uploading the exercises too late. It's been, well, it's not really a good excuse for not uploading it last week, but it's been a very long week. It required a lot of preparations, and sometimes I've also been very bad at answering emails this week. If you've sent me an email and you haven't heard a response, then that's partly because we've had the trial lectures. I know one or two or several of you attended some of these lectures. We've had 7 of them. There's one more next week, and it's been very interesting for us in the committee, and I hope for you students as well, those of you who have attended. You won't hear about the result for a while, sometime next semester only, but we try to keep you updated as much as possible. These things take time in Germany. In Britain, it's much quicker. If you go for a job interview, you're being called up in the evening. I said, we decided to take you, would you like to accept? And then you have to make up your mind very quickly. Here it takes time. Okay, by the way, if you're still working on the assignment, you have a problem. The deadline has passed. I've received almost as many as I had expected. There are a few people who haven't handed it in. I assume that these are people who have decided that they don't want to study English. If you are in a situation where you sort of suddenly have realized, assignment? Oh dear. What was this about? Then, contact me very quickly. It is a required Studienleistung. It's a requirement for you to do this, and if you don't, then I won't be allowed to let you take the exam at the end of the semester or at the end of the course, okay, in April. I will say something more about the exam quite soon, not today, probably next week, just in case you're wondering, but I don't want to spend too much time on that. Right. I think that's all I want to say at the moment regarding organization, unless there is a question from anyone in the audience. No. Yes, there is a question.
Will we get some kind of grading assignment?
You will get some feedback, obviously, usually in the form of points or some sort of, so that you know how many answers you got right. I will also upload a key to what I would have expected you to have submitted. To be honest, I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I won't manage before Christmas. But I hope to give that to you around the first week of the next year, so week 10 of semester or something like that. I'll try. And the question is usually, if I failed, will I fail the course? If I see that you tried, no. Then if you sort of submitted a piece of paper with nonsense, and I can see it's nonsense, then I won't accept it. But if you've made a serious attempt at answering the questions, if you've made a serious attempt, then you really should have got all, not all, but many right. But don't worry about failing this part of the course. It's more important that you've made an attempt. Okay? Okay, let's move over to linguistics. There was quite a bit in last week's lecture. There's going to be quite a bit in this week's lecture too. You will have probably realized that the reading is not very close to what I'm doing. Some things are introduced at different, in slightly different ways. This is also partly to train you to see that the same thing can be described in different ways. It's about the basic points in syntax, but different people will have different, sometimes even terminology, or sometimes different approaches, and it's part of being exposed to this. That's what I'm trying to cover as well. I shouldn't contradict what's in the reading completely. If you feel I do, contact me. Okay. So far, very few people have contacted me directly. I think one or two people had a content question. You are welcome to come and talk to me. I have an office hour. There is absolutely no reason why you shouldn't do this because you're first semester. Office hours are there for everyone to take as an opportunity to ask questions. I don't bite. I'm not particularly nasty. So if you've got a question, rather than listening to what other people might have said, come and talk to me. Right, last lecture we talked about main and subordinate clauses, and I introduced three types of clauses: simple, complex, and compound. Compound meaning two elements on the same syntactic level, usually with a coordinating conjunction like and. And I introduced the concept of complex sentence, which consists of at least two clauses, but one is subordinated to the other. I also make the point again that we have participants and adjuncts, or participants. I could replace this with complements and adjuncts. So elements in the clause that are required to make it grammatical, and adjuncts are elements that are circumstantial, that contain circumstantial information, that are additional information that we can leave out. Then I repeated what I repeated a few times before, namely that there is a difference between form and function, and I showed you different clause types, or different, not necessarily, clause types as well, but also different ways of realizing, for example, a subject. Often it's a noun phrase, sometimes it isn't. And we saw subjects being realized by clauses. Yeah. Right, different clause types. So quite a bit of material, as I said, and I'm not going to repeat all of this again, but some of it will obviously feed into today's lecture, and it might give me an opportunity to mention a few points again, but it's going to be new material too today. I also made the point that, and this is something that might come very handy in an exam, that it's very easy to determine the number of clauses in a sentence if you just count the number of full verbs. Yes, and then we looked at subordinate clauses that have subjects, but then also some that don't have subjects. And this is something that I think will come back to today again. And I asked you to prepare, for some homework, I asked you to prepare a tree for the sentence, Ray regrets hitting the old man with the stick. Okay. And I said I was going to start the lecture by going through this. And this is basically the repetition from last time, because it allows me to mention a few points again before bombarding you with new terminology yet again and telling you more about English syntax. Now, we've got two verbs, and therefore we definitely have two clauses. That's easy. The fact that they're next to each other doesn't mean that they belong together as a verb group, as it's sometimes called. There might be a clause boundary in between. And we'll see this in the tree. Two clauses, that's easy. What are the subjects? Well, this is perhaps a little bit more difficult. Well, not really in terms of the matrix clause or the main clause. Remember, the matrix clause is everything. It includes the subordinate clause. So this is Ray. Now, if we rephrase, or if we say the same thing slightly differently, then we can get out a sentence as follows. Ray regrets that he hit the old man, and then, of course, we have no problem seeing that he is the subject of the subordinate clause. And I suggest that I start drawing the tree with this version of it, and only at the very end then get back to it to see what we do with the subject that's missing. Okay, one way would now be to ask you to come to the front and draw a tree, etc. That's not really manageable in a setting like this. It would be, in a way, preferred, because obviously when you do things actively, then it's easier for you to learn. But I'm now just basically assuming that you've done this, and I would like to show you what I would have expected you to draw in preparation for this lecture. There are two ways of drawing trees. One is to start from top, and one is to start from bottom, meaning starting with the word classes. It's really up to you. There is no rule, really. I personally usually start from the bottom, because it's usually quite easy to start with the word classes. And I think most of you will have very easily, will have been able to determine that Ray is a noun, regrets is a verb, he, noun, hit, verb, etc., etc. I've specifically left the that open for the moment, the subordinator or the conjunction, because we haven't actually really got a label for this yet, but I think you can see what it is. Right, and then we move our way up, and the way we do this is that we look for chunks, we look for constituents, and we can do this by using the kind of tests that I introduced you to last time. So movement tests, substitution tests, etc., etc. And the result of this is then your knowledge of where the boundaries are, and this you can then use to draw the tree. Now I'm just going to draw the tree and then come back to certain tests to confirm that this is the case, but obviously you can do it in the other way around. You can just say, is this a chunk? How can I confirm that this is a constituent, and then start from there. Ray, the subject, is very easy, is a noun phrase. Remember, phrases can consist of a single word. Regrets is part of the verb phrase, but of course the verb regret is a verb that requires something to be regretted. It's a transitive verb. So it's quite easy to start with a very general structure, but then the question is, what follows after regrets? Let's look into the subordinate clause. We have a pronoun, which I've now labeled here as noun because it's the same kind of major category, which is a single word which is in the slot where we could have much more. Ray regrets that the big old man with a stick, etc., etc. And then there would be much more here than just a single word. So this is a noun phrase. The verb must be part of a verb phrase. What kind of verb is hit? Again, it's a verb that requires a hittee, so to speak. Someone who is hit. So we need a complement, we need an object, we need a direct object. Okay. Who is that? And I think it's easy for you to see that the old man is the recipient of the hitting. And notice that I put an adjective phrase above old, because as I've said a couple of times before, we have the potential for more to be there than just a single word. It could be a very old man, and then very old would be a constituent, which would be dominated by this single node, the adjective phrase. And then we have with a stick, which is a noun phrase, which is a complement to with, the preposition. Those together, they form a preposition phrase, which I attach to the verb phrase. So in other words, with the stick is part of the verb phrase. It is dominated by the same node as the old man and the hitting. We know that a standard clause is subject-predicate, so often realized as noun phrase, verb phrase, and that's exactly what we find here. He hit the old man with a stick. And from there, we can link up the two major parts, namely the main clause, or the part of the main clause we see on the left here, Ray regrets, and then that he hit the old man with a stick. I've now put in comp here for complementizer. You can also put subordinating conjunction or something like that. It doesn't matter. All right? What's the function of that he hit the old man with a stick? Anyone? Easy? What's the function of that? Yep. Object, yeah. How can you test this, that it's everything up to here? Everything up to the end and not just up to the old man? Well, for example, you could replace it with the action. And then the action would describe, the action of hitting the old man with a stick. Now, of course, you can also describe an action of just hitting an old man. And it doesn't matter whether it's with a stick or a hammer or whatever cruel way you might find to hit an old man. But in this sentence, if you say the action, then the action replaces everything, including the stick. In fact, we could even replace it with it. Now, if the stick wasn't dominated by, one node, if what I said isn't true, then what we would be able to say would be, Ray regrets it with a stick. No. So the it refers to hitting the old man with a stick. So the replacement test is a very good way of testing how far a particular constituent goes. Okay, here's the whole thing again. Let's look at the verb hit. In fact, we can just look at this part here as a sentence on its own. That's why it says S up here. Because it's some sort of, it's almost a sentence that could stand on its own. Yeah? Well, in fact, it could. He hit the old man with a stick. And we can ask about other types of constituents. For example, can we replace, not necessarily with the same meaning, but can we just replace this with anything else from a formal point of view? Yes, we could, for example, say, he hit the old man viciously. So it's not with what, but in what way. Okay. Again, that slot would replace the whole preposition phrase with the stick, and what we now have is an adverb phrase. We can also say with it, and then the it, which is a pronoun, or as I said last week, actually a pronoun phrase, replaces the stick. And again, we're replacing something that is dominated, and all of what is dominated by one particular node. Okay? And we can go on, hit him with the stick, then him replaces the old man. And again, you've got proof that we've got a constituent. Now, if you look at this sentence again, this is the best picture of an old man with a stick I could find. Is this what we have here? We have an old man who is carrying a stick, and we have a tree for our sentence, he regrets that he hit the old man with the stick. Is there a problem? Sorry, you can't tell? Who of them has a stick? Well, can you not? I mean, you can see that he has a stick. Well, can you tell from the sentence who has the stick? Can anyone tell from the tree whether Ray has the stick or not? Yeah? He refers to Ray, yes, okay.
So,
but as we can see, the old man has the stick. So there's something that doesn't quite match up. Yeah?
I think we just assume that Ray has the stick because we believe that he actually has something.
Yeah. My question is whether structurally this is the same thing. I mean, in terms of experience, it's not the same thing. Clearly not for the old man. It's a difference whether you carry an old stick. No, carry a stick, not an old stick. Or whether you're being hit with one. But my question is this a structural difference, or is this just something that we need to imagine? It's more likely to... Well, what is actually more likely? To hit someone with a stick, or to be old and have a stick? And does that matter? Well, actually, both is possible, right? But is it the same structure? Think about it again. Think about what we've done here, where the constituent boundaries are. Think about what we can replace what have we done with the stick. We've attached it to the VP, meaning to the hitting. This here, this constituent modifies or is part of the verb phrase. Now think about what happens if I just move this down. If I just move this down, okay, this doesn't look good anymore because this is sort of on the same level in terms of visual appearance, but hierarchically we've now changed something. We've moved the constituent further down in the hierarchy. And now we have an old man with a stick. This is hitting the man with a stick. This is hitting the man with a stick. And this is hitting an old man who has a stick. Yeah? Okay. And the difference is structural, and you can see the difference in the tree. Yeah?
Can we do the same with the word phrase, like carrying the stick, the old man carrying the stick, then having the word phrase, and then also moving it down the hierarchy?
Well, think about it. Yes, if Ray is carrying a stick, oh, I am regretting that I hit
Yeah.
Then this is about Ray, who is carrying the stick. Yeah. But if it's actually the old man who's carrying the stick, then we would have to again move it into the noun phrase. Yeah? Does that answer your question? Yeah? And it's a structural difference. The words mean exactly the same thing. There is no difference between this stick and that stick. It's the same stick. Well, I'm not sure whether it's the same stick. It doesn't matter. But, I mean, in terms of meaning, it's the same. Yeah. Right. Okay. A structural difference which is visible in the tree. And that's why trees are a good idea, because you can actually link up meaning or who the participants are, what the circumstantial information is, to where the circumstantial information belongs by looking at the hierarchies in a syntax tree. And this is much more easy, much easier to do than when you just look at the sentence in front of you. Now let's quickly look at this bit here. In fact, the difference between Ray regrets that he hit and Ray regrets hitting is just that we've got no subordinator, we've got no comp slot, as some people call it, and we have no subject. But the subject is notionally, of course, the same as the one in the main clause. So really it is Ray regrets Ray hitting the old man. And we've seen similar sentences before where we had a subordinate clause which didn't have a subject. We'll see a few more, and well, we saw it, for example, with a sentence where there was a two infinitive clause. Okay, I hope many of you had something like this. And if not, then I hope that you've now understood why it should be this tree. Yes?
If we were to do the same, are we allowed to replace hitting by that he hits?
No, but I mean, first of all, let's put it differently. I will be very specific about what I expect from you in the exam. It's probably the easiest way to answer this now. I always try to ask questions in such a way that there is no interpretation. Well, there's no way to interpret it in a way that is negative for you. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, I'll try to be as specific as possible. Whether I always manage is a different question. But that's what I try to do. So you would get a very clear task. For example, one exam question that I have given before was that I gave you two trees. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask you to draw a tree. I gave you two trees, or gave the students two trees, and I asked which of the two trees corresponds to the sentence below. Mm-hmm. Or four sentences, one tree. Which of the four sentences are represented by the tree? You can only answer this if you know about these things, but it's much quicker than just drawing the tree yourself. Okay? So what we've got here in the tree that I just showed you is really ambiguity. And in fact, it's a structural ambiguity. Ambiguity, interestingly, is rare. In the sense that ambiguity that actually causes misunderstanding is rare. It's unlikely, or it's not usually the case, that we find ourselves in a situation where we don't know whether the old man carried a stick or was beaten with a stick. Even though theoretically, looking at the sentence without context, both is possible. But nevertheless, there might be ambiguity, and that can occasionally cause misunderstandings. And there's usually two types. Well, people usually talk about two types of ambiguity. And that ambiguity is either structural, which is an example, well, we've just seen an example of that, or it might be lexical. So it might be because two words mean two different things. Or in fact, it can be a combination. Getting lots of visitors here. Okay. It's okay, you can stay, you can come down. It's all right, I don't mind. Okay. I'll give you a few sentences, and I'd like you to think for a minute about whether the ambiguity that we have here is structural or lexical, or both. All of these are silly headlines. Well, not silly headlines, but they're headlines that you find... well, actually, the first three. The fourth one is something completely different. The first three are actual headlines that were published in British newspapers. British newspapers like doing that. They like to play with language. Now, I'd like you to think about whether we're talking about a lexical or a structural or some other or a combination of both. And the fourth sentence I'm not going to talk about, you need to either understand it or not. If you don't, then look up the words in the dictionary, and I'll leave it at that. So I'll just give you 30 seconds to think about that. Very cruel sentences, some of them. Okay, enraged cow injures farmer with axe. Is that, does anyone not see the ambiguity? Well, it's kind of difficult to see the ambiguity because it's difficult to imagine that there might be a cow running around with an axe. But structurally, theoretically, at least, we can come up with a situation where an axe is wielded by a cow and the poor farmer is injured. Again, this is a structural difference similar to what we've just seen. Perhaps even, well, it's much less likely, one of the two options, but it's a structural ambiguity nevertheless, potentially. Survivor of Siamese twins joins parents. Lexical or structural? Who's in favor of structural? Who's in favor of lexical? Okay, and the other 99%? Right? Okay, this is about the word to join, what it means, whether it's actual physical joining or whether it's a sort of more metaphorical joining, not without actually physically being joined in the same way as Siamese twins are joined. Okay. But other than that, structurally, I would say the two are the same. Eye drops off shelf. So we've got a row of shelves, and there's an eye, and oops, it dropped down, right? So, drop is a verb. Of course, this refers to a situation where some eye drops no longer receive the approval of an authority or something like that, and therefore have to be taken off the shelves, were not allowed to be sold anymore. And the headline made fun, well, used the language in a creative way. And, of course, we have a completely different verb. No, sorry. We have a verb on the one hand and a noun. In fact, eye drops, a compound noun. So we're talking about different meanings, but in fact we're talking about different words. So this is both structural and lexical. Yeah. And I'm not going to discuss the screwing in a light bulb example. I'll leave that up to you to work out the ambiguity if you want to. Okay, next topic. I'd like to have a quick look at one particular class type, and it's one that is shown here on the screen. The student who had not done all the readings failed miserably. It's a very subtle hint that it's a good idea to do the reading. How many clauses? Who's in favor of one? Who's in favor of two? Who's in favor of three? Okay, one or two people? More? No. Okay. Well, I can see two verb groups, or two verbs. Had done, or in fact the negated, had not done, and failed. And in fact, what we have is, we have a subordinate clause, who had not done, all the readings, failed miserably. What kind of clause is this? You know this, you learn this in school. It's a relative clause. Okay. What's the function of a relative clause? What's the function of this relative clause? Yes?
To give more detail?
To give more detail is not really a function. You've got, I mean, what's the technical word for it then? You're absolutely right, but... Sorry? Yeah, but that's not a function. Yes? That's also not a function. Yes? It's an addition, and what? Yes? It's an adjunct, yes. Again, it's some sort of, it's some additional information. Okay. You could just say the student failed miserably. It's not the participant in the sense that we need the needed in the sentence for the verb to be complete in the sense of having all its participants. So it gives additional information about the student. And in fact, this is just as much an adjunct as lazy in the lazy student who had not done all the readings. It's just that lazy pre-modifies student, while who had not done all the reading post-modifies student. What's the subject in the sentence on top? Yes? It happens almost every time. No, it's not the student. Yes? Yes, okay. Why? Because it post-modifies student. Hierarchically, it's dominated by the same node. If you use the replacement test, you say, he failed miserably, and he replaces the student who had not done all the reading. Okay. Yes, I can see why you said it. And I can see... Yeah. But syntactically speaking, the answer is wrong, I'm afraid. Okay? So, what's the subject? We've done that. The student who had not done all the reading. Or in fact, the lazy student who had not done all the readings. So we seem to have a subclause inside the noun phrase. So this who had not done all the reading modifies student. It's a verb phrase that we have here, therefore it must be a clause. So we now have not only clauses functioning as subject, but clauses functioning as modifiers in a noun phrase. What's the difference between those two sentences? And again, this is, in a way, I think, something that you should know, or will expect you to know. What's the difference between the student who had not done all the readings and students who tend to get their degrees before the age of 25 or something like that? There will be some people in the audience who are above 25, but many of you are probably going to be quite a bit below 25, and there's a good chance that you're going to get your bachelor's degree before you turn 25. What's the difference? Well, the first one is about a specific student who is currently endangering the reality that I describe in the second sentence. Namely, that students generally get their degree before they are 25. So this is about students in general, the species of students, if you want, while the first one is about a very specific student. Children who perform well at school have better chances. Before I even finished reading this sentence, when I show the sort of the question, what's the difference, to many people, then the answer I get is the comma. Right? And yes, that's true. This one has commas, and this one doesn't have commas. And in fact, there is a prescriptive rule about this, that these types of sentences, or these types of relative clauses, require commas. Now, the problem is that British or American native speakers don't care so much about rules in many ways, and they will often violate these rules. Comma rules are more flexible in American and British English than they are in German. They're also different in American and British English from German. And I always notice when I get papers from students that they tend to use German punctuation. Mm-hmm. It's something that you will need to internalize. But this is not a writing course. Yeah. But the point is, this is not so much about the comma, this is about what these sentences and these relative clauses do. So that's why I specifically left out the comma, but the difference is still there. Children who perform well at school have better chances of getting a well-paid job. Children who normally know how to tie their shoes at the age of 5 have major problems with English spelling. The first one refers to a restricted subset, namely only those children who are actually doing well at school, while the second one is a generally accepted fact or an observable fact about children in general, unless they grow up only with shoes that don't have things to tie, but just sort of, well, you know what I mean. So, the first one is restricted, the second one is not restricted. That's why we call the first one a restrictive relative clause, and the second one a non-restrictive relative clause, or a defining and a non-defining relative clause. And when you're being asked what the difference is, then you explain the meaning rather than whether there is a comma or not. Notice that relative clauses can come in various ways, in various, well, not disguises, but look at this one. This is the book I lost last year. We don't have a that or a which. So this is really equivalent to this is the book that I lost last year. Mm-hmm. And this is something which is very common, particularly in spoken language. In spoken language, we tend to leave out things. We're lazy, right? Human beings are lazy. And this is one way of doing it. I'm not saying that all of language uses lazy, but this is one where people tend to leave out certain parts, and it's a zero relative clause. What about this one? The man seen on this picture, or half of the tickets available to Liverpool fans were sold abroad. There's some disagreement in the literature, but one way to look at this is basically to say that these are reduced relative clauses, in the sense that I'm deleting the relativizer who, or that, plus the verb, and that's why some people call this whiz deletion. But don't worry about this term, this is for the people who want to know more than just the basics. Okay. No task today for the break, but I think since I'm sort of spot on in the middle of it, do nothing for 2 minutes. Okay. Okay, let's continue. So we've got quite a few slides to go through. I'd like to look at verb phrases in a bit more detail now. We already know quite a few things. We know that verb phrases must contain a verb because I said that each phrase has a head, a most important element, and in the case of the verb phrase, well, it's a verb because a verb phrase is called verb phrase. And we also looked at certain types of verbs, and some of them require objects. I introduced the terms transitive and ditransitive verbs. And these are then complements that are required to make the sentence or the verb phrase complete. We also saw that some of the verbs, well, verbs can have different word forms. I introduced the term lexeme in morphology, different word forms, or lemma, different word forms being part of a lexeme. And I introduced different types of verbs in the sense that they can be full verbs or modal verbs or auxiliary verbs. And as I'm sure you know, there are different ways a verb group, this is a term often used by linguists, to refer to everything that belongs to the verbal part, that is, to the predicator, for example, that's another way of calling it. So, he interviews many people, then interviews is that predicator, it's the head of the verb phrase, interviews many people. It can consist of more than one word, has interviewed many people, or was interviewed by Larry King, or might have interviewed many people, or was being interviewed when the shot fell, or should have been interviewed but wasn't, or should be being interviewed right now but isn't, or might have been being interviewed while I was looking for him. This is rare, but it exists. Very, very rare. But it's possible to come up with a verb group that consists of five lexical elements. We also have something like, I suggest that he be interviewed. Looks wrong, but is one way of saying something that should happen. It's a subjunctive, as I will say later on. Now, encoded in these differences are certain differences with regard to various aspects of meaning. Or, well, this structure reflects what the verb group means. So, when does it happen? Now? In the past? In the future? When does it happen in, not in contrast, but with respect to or in relation to another element in the sentence? Is this a completed action or is it ongoing? Am I certain about what I'm saying or am I perhaps expressing, am I expressing something that is, or the fact that I'm not so sure, I might be able to do this, etc. And all of these aspects, or all of these points, are covered in the way the verb group is formed, or are expressed by the verb group in different ways. Now, this is sort of the lay way of talking about it. The linguistic terms are tense, aspect, mood, and voice. And I would like to introduce each of these very quickly to you, because they refer to how the verb group is structured, or how the verb group is structured has an impact on, well, those four terms. Before we do this, I'd like to remind you of the different types of verbs. Lexical verbs, full verbs, so verbs like go or hit or kiss or stumble or what do I have here, come and extrapolate or something like that. And then the so-called helping verbs, the auxiliaries, will, would, should, can, might, may, etc., etc. And then there are the primary verbs, be, have, and do. Just to remind you of this. First, what I'd like to start with is tense. In a sentence like, I like chocolate, or he likes chocolate, or he eats chocolate, the verb tells me something about when it happens. We can compare this to, I stumbled last night, he stumbled last night, or he ate chocolate, and obviously you know that the first one is an example, or the first set of three are examples of present tense, and the second one of past tense. So far, so easy. I will meet her tomorrow. No, sorry, tonight. I'm playing football tonight. Which tense? Future tense. Well, think about it. How is the future? This is about the future. How is it expressed? How is it encoded? How is it grammatically marked on the verb? Well, we have a will. We have an in I am playing. And we have a lexical item that refers to something which is in the future. But it's not something that is marked on the verb in the same way, I mean morphologically. So, there is no future tense in English. This is about the future. My plane leaves at 5 p.m. It doesn't do it now, but it leaves at 5 p.m. This is a present tense verb, but it still refers to the future. And it's one way of referring to the future in English. But there isn't a morphological, inflectional ending that marks future. There is in other languages, but not in English. And that's why most linguists, not all, but most linguists say there are only two tenses. And this has been, well, this was in the past an exam question. Often I give you exam questions like statements. For example, English has three tenses. And then you need to tell me just true or false. The answer would be false because English only has two tenses. Now, one important aspect which also helps us understand some of the trees and the nature of subordinate clauses is the concept of finiteness. Have a look at the sentences here. He goes to London and he went to London. Which tense? Well, present tense, past tense. Fine. He gone to London. Is that okay? Well, the asterisk says no. Unless it's non-standard English. Certain non-standard Englishes have this way of forming the past tense. But in standard British and standard American English, this is not a way to form the past tense. He going to London. Again, non-standard. He to go to London. No. Okay. He go to London. No. Right? Because he is third person singular, we need the third person S marking. So the only two sentences that work are really the first two. He went to London catching a train. That's fine, right? We can't say going to London, or we can't say I catching train, but I can say he went to London catching a train at noon. I can also say to catch a train he walked to the station, or having gone to London he returned home. So it seems that it's possible to do it if the verb is in a subordinate clause. He regretted hitting the old man with a stick. The hitting is different from that he hit in one particular way, namely that it encodes information about when it happened. What is the tense? I mean, what do we know anything about when catching a train at noon happened? Well, yes, we know, because he went to London. So it must have happened in the past. But is this because of the catching, or is this because of the went? I can say he went to London catching a train at noon. I can say he will go to London catching a train at noon. And I can say he goes to London catching a train at noon, and even I can talk about the past. He had gone to London catching a train at noon when I called him, or something like that. And we've got exactly the same element in the subordinate clause, but we've got differences in the verb phrase of the main clause. So catching a train can't be used, or we can't see it to mean anything specific about time. It's really only in conjunction with the clause to which it is attached that we receive information about when it happened. So we need more than just the subordinate clause in order to know whether it's in the past or in the future or right now or something like that. The way to express this linguistically is to say that catching does not carry tense. It does not carry any information about whether it's now or in the past. This makes it a non-finite verb. And a finite verb then is obviously something like he went to London, where in the verb itself, information about whether it's in the past or not is encoded. He has gone to London, he will have gone to London, he might have gone to London for a while. As you can see, there are some blue bits. These are part of the verb group. But then there's also some red bits, and these are the bits that carry tense. Has gone versus had gone. What tense is this? Present tense. Ever wondered about why present perfect is present perfect? Well, because it's present tense. As opposed to past perfect. Okay. And modal verbs also carry tense. So, if a verb group is finite, that is, it contains tense information, it will always carry this tense information in the first part of the verb group. So he might have been being interviewed while I was looking for him. The might contains the bit that carries tense. Modal verbs, I'm sure you know about, I also briefly introduced them. They can only function as auxiliary verbs. They don't have inflections. You can't say he might do this. Okay. English modals are really complex. Can't go into any great detail. Various types of meaning: permission, obligation, volition. These are terms that I don't expect you to know by heart. And oh, by the way, I will upload the no list for the syntax block of lectures. After the fourth lecture. Okay. Just a few examples of modal verbs. He's driving a Rolls Royce. He must be rich. What does this express? Is it must as in you must finish or you must hand in your assignment? No, of course it's not. It's about, well, he's driving a Rolls Royce. He probably has lots of money, otherwise he couldn't afford the Rolls Royce, so he must be rich. So it's a different kind of meaning from you must do this now. You should have started your work on this earlier. This might be the best thing to do, and you must go now. So modals are very varied in their meaning. And this isn't a lecture about the model. You can have a lecture course on models if you want, because it's something quite complex. But I just wanted to mention a few. Right. He catches a train to London. This is about, lots about trains, right? He catching a train to London. This doesn't work in a simple sentence. So, in a simple sentence, the verb always carries tense. But as we've already seen, this is not necessarily the case in a subordinate clause. We can have, I know that he likes chocolate, or we can have something like, he regrets that he hit, but we can also have, I hate to see you cry. How many clauses does this sentence have? Who's in favor of one, two, three, yeah. Hate, see, cry. Is cry a verb? So it's a very short sentence, actually contains three clauses. But you don't need to worry about this now. You need to worry about the fact that to see is a non-finite verb, which is in a subordinate clause. And there are some verb groups that contain modals, and as I said before, these always carry tense. Yeah. So basically, a finite verb is a verb that is either morphologically marked, so contains an inflectional element that marks tense, or a word that is, a modal verb. Okay, that was tense. Let's move over to aspect. And many people mix up aspect and tense. But strictly speaking, and in fact some of our language teachers might do that, because they're looking at it from a different perspective. I'm not telling you sort of the hardcore linguistic one, and again, I know this is annoying, but you might find different descriptions of the same thing. It's just the way it is in linguistics. John crosses the street is present tense. What is the tense in John is crossing the street? Present tense, because we've got is. John crossed the street. John was crossing the street when a car swerved around and was around the corner at high speed. Clearly, past tense. Now, one way of nicely illustrating this is to use sort of bar or a line to indicate time. We start in the past, we end up in the future, and somewhere on this line is the now, or when the speech event happens. Which of these sentences refers to this particular setup, where this blue arrow points here with respect to the speech act? Is it John crosses the street? No, it's not happening now. John is crossing the street? No, it's not happening now. So it must be John crossed the street. It's a single point in time, but it's in the past. This is an example of the simple aspect. Now, if you think about what has to happen for the second past tense sentence to be described visually, then I think you can see, we need two parts. We need, on the one hand, when something happens, namely the swerving, but then we need some background information or something that is carried out for a longer period of time, namely was crossing the street. Well, a longer period of time can be a few seconds, but it's still conceptualized, also from the grammatical point of view, as something that is progressive. That's why it's called the progressive aspect. So it happens in the past, around the time when something else happened. And the swerved is a past tense, and the was crossing is a past tense finite verb because the first element is marked for time. Okay, Britain has become. Is that perfect or present? Sorry, forget that. Is that present or past tense? Easy. Has. Present. Present tense. Again, we can show this. It's in the past. But it has some significance for today. So, it's completed, but it's still relevant now. And that's exactly what the present perfect expresses in English. Now, if we want to change this to had become, basically what we do is just move this somewhere to the back. So a past event that had relevance up to a certain point in time. Fine? So really what we have is four different options. I am laughing, I have laughed, I laugh, and I have been laughing. I've got the progressive tense. Progressive aspect. Perfect aspect. Neither, sometimes known as simple aspect. Or both. So both progressive and perfect. So if we look at the combinations, then we can draw up a simple table, but maybe not quite so simple table, where we say, well, present and past and progressive and perfect, and we've got all four options. So much about English not having any grammar. Right? Yes, not many inflections, but this is only the beginning, because as you'll see, we can mix this, not mix this up, but we can add additional categories into the picture. Like voice. The student read the book. Active. Easy, right? You know about passive and active, obviously. Was read by the student. Passive voice. Is this present or past tense? Well, it's a past tense verb carrying tense, therefore it's a perfect, it's a passive gosh, it's been a very long week this time. I have to say this once a lecture, right? And it's a long week. But it is usually a long week. Anyway. And you know that in the passive, the object of the active version becomes the subject of the new sentence. Yeah. And then often if you've got a long passive, the subject moves into a preposition phrase. But, yeah. The book was banned. My car was stolen last year. In fact, we don't need the subject or the subject of the active version or the active variant. And some people distinguish between long passives and short passives. If the preposition phrase is there that used to be the subject of the active, then it's a long passive. Before I show you the combinations that we can have, I'd like to show you something which is quite special. And I'd like you to tell me whether this is an active or a passive. This book reads well. Is it passive or active? Hmm? Yes, exactly. So semantically it doesn't make sense, but structurally, in terms of the actual forms, it is an active, right? So of course we know that books are being read, but there is a way in English of expressing sort of some kind of ambiguous or medial way between the active and the passive. This auditorium seats, well, not 1,000, but more than 300. this car drives well, we can say, etc. So we've got an active structure of a passive meaning. Some people call this the middle construction or the medial passive. Okay. And this is really just for people who are interested. So we've got a participant that is non-agent but is presented as central. We'll come back to questions like this when we look at text linguistics, how and why things are structured in a sentence and beyond sentences, because it means that you can highlight something in a different way than from saying the book is being read. Can you spot the passives here? I'm running a little bit late, but I'd like to give you a minute to think about this. I'm sure many of you find many passives, which is not a big surprise because there are some text types. We'll be talking about variation in syntax next week, where I'll say a little bit about which text types are more likely to exhibit certain structures than others. And this is a legal text, and it's not uncommon at all for this type of text to contain passives. It's more formal. And in fact, there are even passives like "are required to be prepared," which is in fact two clauses, right? Because "require" is a verb and "prepare" is a verb. So we've got a syntactically nested structure. Is satisfied, is specified, have been prepared, have been adopted, etc. So in fact, we have more mix and match then. Active, present, and progressive. She is training the dog. Active, present, perfect. She has trained the dog. Past, passive, present, past, present. And again, quite clearly, English does have quite a bit of grammar. One last thing, mood. Now, mood is a grammatical category. Mood is also something else. You can be in a good mood, or you can be in a bad mood. And you can also have a sentence having a certain type of quality or something like that, from a literary point of view. But this is not the mood that we refer to in linguistics. This is to do with speaker attitude, how true something is. So we have modal verbs being involved, but we also have some ways of marking mood on the verb, and I'll show that to you in a minute. So this has nothing to do, particularly my British students used to link this up to literary mood in the sense of a somber mood of a text or something like this. Mood refers to the verb group in a verb phrase. And you can say for every single verb phrase what the mood is. And there are three options: the indicative, the subjunctive, and the imperative. And this is about being factual, hypothetical, or directive. So when you hear mood linguistically, it's something different. So to give you one example, the subjunctive, which is fairly rare in English, it's more common in French, those of you who speak French. I insist that he finish immediately. This is not a typo, this is not a mistake, but it's a subjunctive. Be he alive or be he dead, I want his, I don't know, something. Head? Well, then he's probably dead, but yeah. God save the Queen. This is not a mistake, but it is may God save the Queen. And in the past tense, we have things like if I were you, where prescriptive linguists say that this is the only way of phrasing it. You also hear nowadays a lot, if I was you, I wouldn't do this. Okay. And again, well, this is a question of preference nowadays. If I were a rich man, were it to turn out that, etc. So we always have were instead of was. Subjunctive is one of the moods, the indicative is the norm, and the third option is the imperative, and I don't think I need to introduce the imperative. I can ask you to spot it. Spend 20 seconds finding a few. This is a very typical text type. Recipes. One way you find probably the most imperatives from a text type specific perspective. So peel, set, heat, add, stir fry, add, etc., etc. Okay, I've still got a few more slides, but I'd like to sum up before I show you the last few slides. So don't pack up yet, I will need a few more minutes. But still, I think it's a good idea to summarize a few points first. I made the point that English has only two tenses. So don't ever, well, you can, but in a linguistic context, don't ever talk about the future tense again, unless you know what you're doing, okay? We tend to see only two tenses. I also introduced you to the important distinction between finite and non-finite verbs. And I showed you that non-finite verbs can only exist in subordinate clauses. And I make the point that if you've got a longer verb group, only the first element carries tense. So, might be interested, the might carries tense. Or was being interviewed, was carries tense. I then introduced you to four grammatical categories, which are marked on the verb, which you can sort of morphologically see, usually. Aspect, voice, and mood. Well, morphologically and lexically. That wasn't right. But anyway, I introduced you to four categories: aspect, voice, mood, and tense. Well, here, aspect, voice, and mood are features that can change from one verb phrase to the next. And I made the point that it's not a good idea to talk about the mood of a verb phrase, well, a mood of a text in the sense that it refers to whether it's a somber mood or a bright mood or something like that. This is not what's meant. I also made the point that subjunctives are rare in English. And this is about formal aspects of grammar rather than meaning. Of course, it expresses meaning, but these are formal aspects. I'd like to end this lecture with a final point about traits. If you compare the two sentences here, in the first case, we have the verb give. So, he gave the man an apple. What kind of verb is give? And I think I've introduced that before. It's the prototypical ditransitive verb, expressing transfer. Give somebody something. So, ditransitive. What kind of verb is want? You want something? It only requires one internal participant in terms of internal verb phrase participant and one subject. So, I want something. So, it's transitive. So, what is the second then in terms of function? Well, it gives additional information, so of course, it is an adjunct. It is not a complement. How would you show this in a tree? He gave the man an apple. It's fairly easy, I think. He, the noun phrase, the man is a noun phrase, an apple is a noun phrase, and we can link this up all under one node, and we can see that the man and an apple belong to complete the verb give. What would the tree look like for he wants an answer this second? Well, basically the same, right? In a way, at least based on what I've shown you so far. We don't really, We don't really have a difference between this and that, apart from the fact that it's different words. But of course, this is not a complement, it's an adjunct. But we don't see this in the tree. Now this is really only for people who want to know a bit more, and it's only two slides, but there is a way to express this. No, you don't need to know this for the exam, but don't pack up yet. Just give me 2 minutes. Okay. There is a way of showing this by introducing an additional level in the tree. He wants an answer this second. I've now introduced the so-called bar level. Well, it's not a bar, it's an apostrophe, but that's because when they introduced this theory, typewriters couldn't easily do bars on top of letters, so that's why they do it like this. Have a look at this one again. What do we have here? We have give, which is the verb, the head of the verb phrase, on the same hierarchical level as the complements. Verb, a noun phrase are immediately dominated by VP. That's why, so in other words, they're sisters. That's why both are complements, because complements are sisters of head, of the head of the verb phrase. Look at this. We have one element which is, okay, not visually, but in terms of structure, on the same level. But this here is, the noun phrase this second, is on the same level as V bar. An answer is a complement. The second is an adjunct. So, complements are sisters of the head level. Adjuncts are sisters of bar level. You can do the same thing with adjective phrases. This is how we do... We in a way introduce another level that now puts man and happy not as... well, not on the same level, but we can compare this with this. This is a sister of head, this is a sister of bar. And this way, you can have a way of visualizing this in the tree. Now, as I said, this is only for people who want to think well beyond what we've done. It also wasn't explained in the most understandable way. And I won't bother you with this kind of trees anymore. I just wanted to show you that there is much more around. Again, not next week when I talk about a few other things relating to syntax, I'll again say one or two things that go beyond. But don't worry, in the no lists, I'll make it very clear what is required and what is not required. So, see you next Friday.